regulation to ethics is now taking place away from the private superpowers of Silicon Valley. In Singapore, Estonia, Germany, India, China, even Oakland. Our map is a multidimensional one. Our five tools for building the map of the future: regulation, innovation, social responsibility, worker and consumer choice, and education are all essential building blocks of the future, but they aren't cut off from one another. As we've shown, there is no innovation without regulation, and as my conversations with socially responsible venture capitalists like John Borthwick, Frida Kapoor Klein, and Steve Case demonstrate, successful innovators and wealthy investors can and should be good citizens too. This combinatorial architecture is critical to fixing the future. Government regulation and free market innovation aren't in themselves sufficient solutions. Their value lies in being combined, consciously or otherwise, with our other tools. The new geography outlined on our map is also an old geography. Certainly nothing ever really changes in terms of the way in which dramatic disruption requires humans to assert their agency in order to fix the future. Pretty much everything about today's digital revolution has, one way or another, happened before. Even the Moore's Law versus Moore's Law debate, which boils down to the question of whether humans have real agency, is a recurring discussion throughout history. It preoccupied 19th-century critics of capitalism, pitting deterministic Marxist-Leninists with their faith in the inevitability of history against socialist humanists like Rosa Luxemburg. And it was the most controversial theological issue of the 16th century, dividing Renaissance humanists such as Erasmus and Thomas More from Martin Luther and other Reformation preachers. What I hope this book has shown is that designing a coherent map of the future requires a coherent knowledge of the past. That's why knowledge of the history of humanism is so valuable in an age in which we are once again grappling with the eternal issue of what it means to be human. That's why the history of the 19th century Industrial Revolution is so instructive in helping us make sense of the early digital 21st century. And that's why a familiarity with the modern history of everything from robber baron capitalism to the contemporary automobile and food industries can be so useful today in determining how best to reform the most troubling aspects of the digital revolution. But there is still a final question. One last thing to answer about the map drawn in this book. Just as Thomas More and his humanist friends created a map of utopia that, when looked at in a certain way, reveals something quite unexpected, a human skull, we too need to reimagine our map's message. So, if you step back from the map laid out in this people's book and look at it with fresh eyes, what or whom should you see? Rather than a skull, what you should see is the image of a young person. I dedicated this book about fixing the future for our kids, but this might have been a little patronizing. For our kids assumes that they lack agency of their own and that the future is something finished, something we adults will donate to them once it has been fixed. But the good news is that our kids, as activists, entrepreneurs, and consumers, are already actively shaping this future. As we saw, for example, at the Kapoor Center hackathon in Oakland, it's young people like Tiffany Smith, the MBA graduate student from Chicago, with the app for empowering the previously incarcerated, who are using technology for the social good. These kinds of hackathons are becoming increasingly popular among young technologists and social entrepreneurs. Indeed, the San Francisco-based technology nonprofit group Code for America even now organizes an annual Code Across Hackathon Day for the Social Good. It is held simultaneously in numerous countries around the world, including Brazil, South Korea, Pakistan, and Croatia. That muscle, which Credo Principal Chip Romer says is essential to good citizenship, is being strengthened by young people's commitment to technology for the good. The more you use it, you'll remember Romer saying of this muscle, the stronger it becomes. Much has been made of young people as digital natives, the vanguard of the network revolution. But it's no coincidence that these sentimental commentaries tend to be written by older people who have a romanticized Rousseauian faith in the supposedly intuitive literacy of our kids. The truth, however, is that it is our kids who are the grizzled realists of all things digital, especially as consumers. It's these kids, for example, who are pioneering the revenge of analog, a return to the future of handwritten notebooks, printed books, and vinyl records, the new billion-dollar music business that now generates more profit than the entire streaming industry. This isn't a Luddite moment. Young people certainly aren't smashing their digital devices. Instead, as consumers, they are discovering that some meaningful things, like listening to high-quality music recordings and reading or writing complex ideas, are most enjoyably done physically rather than virtually. Indeed, they are even beginning to pay again for their internet content, with the Reuters Institute reporting that the proportion of people aged between 18 and 24 in the United States paying for their online news rose from 4% in 2016 to 18% in 2017. Ultimately, too, a solution to the great cultural problems of the networked age, digital overconsumption, distraction, and above all, addiction, will also originate from our kids. As Nicholas Carr told me, there's never been a countercultural movement in history that hasn't come from young people. Digital culture, especially obsessive social media usage, has become so stultifyingly orthodox that it will inevitably be rejected by future generations of free-thinking kids. Just as the kids of the 60s rebelled against the cloying consumerism of late 20th century capitalist society, so too, I suspect, we are now on the brink of a youthful rebellion against an increasingly conformist digital lifestyle of endless tweets, Facebook updates, and Snapchats. Rather than rejecting digital culture, however, the most important challenge for young people is getting our new 21st century operating system to work properly. The new networked world that we are now navigating is in some ways profoundly foreign to the industrial one. It's an unfamiliar map. For example, new divisions between nationalists and globalists have replaced the old conservative versus liberal political debates of the 20th century, thereby signaling the end of the left and the right as we know them. Young people are on the progressive side of this debate, voting disproportionately against Trump and Brexit. In the UK, 75% of 18 to 24-year-olds voted to stay in the EU. In the United States, Hillary Clinton won 55% of the millennial electorate. The digital transformation of the world is central to this new 21st century debate between nationalists and globalists. As the Financial Times' John Thornhill predicts, the more internationalist-minded tech industry may well act as a counterweight to the increasingly inward-looking nativism seen in the US and the UK. But, as we've seen in this book, the direction of this new technocentric internationalism will come as much from Germany, Estonia, India, and Singapore as it will from Silicon Valley. And all this change is still in its very earliest stages. It's 1850 all over again. A familiarly unfamiliar moment. Nothing, nothing, nothing. That's how Brad Burnham described this kind of epical change in which a whole generation will reinvent the world. The next chapter in our human narrative. And then, something dramatic.
This has been an Audible Studios production of How to Fix the Future. Written by Andrew Keen. Performed by L.J. Ganser. Executive producers Kristen Lang and Mike Charzik. Copyright 2018 by Andrew Keen. Sound recording copyright 2017 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.